My guest today is Dr. Alok Kumar. Dr. Kumar is a distinguished professor of physics at the State University of New York, Oswego, and he is the author of the famous book, I hope it's famous by now, the book, this one here, which I have recommended many times on this channel, Ancient Hindu Science. It's a book, the viewers of my channel will know that I have recommended this book many times. I've also done a giveaway of this book. It's an excellent book about the Hindu science over the centuries and the millennia. So, Dr. Kumar, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here with me today.
Namaste, Abhijit ji, and thank you so much for inviting me. It's a great honor for me to interact with you, have conversations with you, and with your viewers also.
It's my honor and my privilege, sir, to have you on the podcast. So, Dr. Kumar, what's your story? You were born in India, and then as part of your career, as part of your journey, you moved to the United States. I think you have spent most of your life and your career in North America. So, could you give an overview of how the journey was like?
See, I was raised in Holy City, Haridwar. And so, whatever I have achieved, I attribute to that town. And when I was in my early 20s, I decided to come to America. And my parents, they did not want me to come here, being the baby of the family, they said, no, you are not going there. When I insisted, they said, okay, promise me a few things. And those things were that you will do something for the country, and you will do something for the religion. So this is how I promised them that, okay, I'm going to write a book, dealing with Hindu science. And that started my journey. So the first thing that I tried to do is I tried to search Indian libraries, and I could not find a single book on Hindu science. And that was pretty discouraging. But I'm talking by the 70s, so when I could not get a book, I became more and more interested in that. I came to America, and when I started looking for books, I did find books, but the information was scattered. It was not compiled in a single book, And I felt that, every generation must compile the knowledge of the previous generation, improve upon it, and pass it to the next generation. It's the duty of every generation. Otherwise, that knowledge is going to disappear. I can give you a few examples of that we all love food cooked by our, mother. But how many of us learned those recipes? Very rarely. And once mother is gone, we miss her and we miss those recipes. So I decided that I must do that. And that's how I initiated this book.
Right. So you found it really difficult to locate any text on Indian, on ancient Hindu science, right? So what libraries did you consult? Where all did you look for this?
I basically, since I was in, India at that time,
India.
I was working in IITs. Okay. IITs had no book related to India, so I failed. Then I came to Los Angeles, and that's where I found most of my books. The library facilities in Los Angeles are much, much better. Then I came to New York, and here also the library facilities are excellent.
Right. So what texts were you able to locate that started you off on the journey to discovering the truth about Hindu science, ancient Hindu science?
See, when I realized that You know, I was taught that India had a great past. This was, you know, the knowledge my parents shared with me. And I thought, if India was a great civilization, then other civilizations must have written something about India. So I decided that, okay, I'm going to go through the Greek literature, Egyptian literature, European literature, and the Middle Eastern literature. And that was an eye-opener. You know, when I started reading, then I realized why Alexander the Great took this arduous journey to India, you know, or why Columbus wanted to come to India, or why Vasco da Gama wanted to come to India. India indeed was a great civilization, and it was a very rich country. I mean, today we know that Indian GDP in the BC period was one third of the whole world's GDP. So these countries did write about India. And if you extract that information, then you realize that, my God, why are we not telling this information to Indians or to Hindus? And that's how I wrote that book.
Right. So I have said this many times on my channel, that what happened about 1,000 years ago is that our country, our civilization was invaded by the Turks. They were able to successfully conquer the country and occupy the country. And what they did was they destroyed all our universities. We had universities throughout the length and the breadth of the country. They destroyed all the universities. They burned all the libraries. The library at Nalanda is known to have burned for months. So that's the kind of destruction that was perpetrated. And that's how we lost all the written records of our past, and also all the science and all the information that was that had been compiled and discovered over thousands of years. And before this happened, before the destruction happened, the Arabs, their translators came to India. They took all the texts that were valuable to them, like pharmacology, toxicology, astronomy, mathematics, physics, logic, philosophy, maybe not philosophy, but whatever was valuable to them from a practical perspective. They translated all of that into their language, Arabic. And that's how the westward transmission began. It eventually reached Europe and gave rise to the Industrial Revolution and all that. So clearly, if we look at Arabic texts and also more ancient Greek texts, etc., we would find evidence of what our ancestors had been doing. So which texts were notable in your opinion, from which you were able to compile some really good information?
Okay. First, let me talk about, since you have mentioned the Middle East. Mm-hmm. If you see, the top natural philosophers of the Middle East, they were Al-Khwarizmi, Al-Biruni, and Ibn al-Laban, Al-Razi, and so on. If you read their books, on the very first page, many of them are writing that this is the knowledge of Hind. I'm simply presenting it to you. And that was an eye-opener, because, for example, the title of Al-Khwarizmi book, and when I'm saying Al-Khwarizmi, you should understand, he is perhaps the top natural philosopher of the Islamic golden age of Islam. The person who is number one, he is famous for three books. And two books, like Ziz al-Sindh Hind. It says Hind, you know, so the title is saying it. Another book he wrote on arithmetic. Again, the title says Hind. The third book on algebra, the title does not say it, but in it, he is basically sharing Indian knowledge, or Hindu knowledge at that time, that's what he called. So if the top philosophers were writing that, I I wondered about it, why this information is not shared in India and why it is not a common knowledge. And then I realized another thing that I read, if you read the European literature prior to 14th century, then India is written in glorious terms, that India was a great civilization and made advances in sciences. In fact, there is a book written in 11th century Spain where for the first time a scientist decided to compile a global history of science and rank those civilizations. And India was ranked number one. So that was the European knowledge that later on disappeared because Europe decided to subjugate India. That was the reason, you know. I can give you one example. Roger Bacon, he is a philosopher who lived in, I think, 14th century. He wrote a book, Opus Majus, where on the instruction of the Pope, and the purpose was how to Christianize India. And he is saying it very clearly that this is a great civilization, better than us. In a few hundred years, we became backward, barbaric, savage, and it was the white man's burden to civilize us, like Rudyard Kipling, wrote about it, white man's burden. So this is how history changed from year to year, which is a very well-known accepted fact, that the history that we are teaching is Eurocentric. Unfortunately, in India, that's not a common knowledge.
Right. In India, it's not common knowledge. And what's happened is that everything we are teaching, the entire education system, is still rooted. It's still based in the 19th century colonial system that the British instituted. And we are simply continuing that. And like you mentioned, before the colonial era began, the Europeans spoke about India in glowing terms, and so did the Arabs. The knowledge that passed into Europe via the Arabs was all translations. Essentially, these great philosophers, etc., they were only translators. They translated Indian texts, and they did not try to hide it. They, like you say, they put the title Hind in the title of the text. So it's very clear they are saying that we are simply sharing Indian knowledge. But later on, the Europeans tried to censor the word India out, and they tried to steal the credit away from India. And that's the knowledge that's been passed on to India. It's all European in origin. So, and that's what Indians believe today. And that's what leads to all the mental colonization, the lack of confidence, and all of that. So it's very interesting that you bring this out. So how long did it take you? I mean, how many books have you written? I think you've written more than one book, right?
I have written four books.
Four books, okay.
On this topic. And I have to say that my books, you will find it in most libraries or many libraries around the world. So whether it's Paris or London or Sydney or Munich and Frankfurt, you can find that book. However, you will not find these books in India. And that's the truth, you know.
And why is that?
I have no idea. I have tried my level best to publicize. The Press Trust of India has written, issued a news release, but very few newspapers have covered those.
Well, so, the thing is that in the 21st century, nobody reads press releases, nobody reads newspapers. Today, this is the world of social media. If you want to publicize something, especially something good, we need to use social media. We need to use the audio visual medium and all. So that's what we are doing today. Hopefully the word spreads. Right. Yeah. Right. So you have written 4 books and these were all published in the US initially. Were
that they? That is true. All 4 books. And what one is published by University of Texas Press. In fact, that was my first book. And it did very, very well. It was written about 32 years ago, 30 years ago.
Okay.
It is available all over the world, but not in India. You cannot find it. And this is the book where it's based on this Spanish document I mentioned that's ranked different cultures based on their contribution to science, and India was ranked number one. Right. And I thought Indian media will pick it up. Unfortunately, that did not happen.
Has there been some kind of resistance from Indian publishers to publish it in India? What is the deal? Because it's rather curious that books about Indian history and Indian science are not published in India. What do you think the reason for this is?
I do not know the reason, but there is a great reluctance in the Indian media to focus on these things. It's interesting, you know. In India, it is commonly said, "Oh, how good is history? It's a old information. Why do we need it?"
Yeah.
And then, particularly the leftist, they push that, big time. They forget that Karl Marx wrote his thesis, doctoral thesis, on Lucretius, and it's a work on the history of science. There, he has written that perhaps Democritus went to India. You are never going to hear that in India. It's an unfortunate situation, you know. I do not know what to do about it, you know.
Right. So I'm really glad that at least this one book currently is available in India. I think it is. I have spread the word to some people. So if we talk about this particular book, which I think is your latest book, how long did it take you to write this book, do the research?
The total time I think I have spent is close to 3 decades.
3 decades.
30 years, yes. And the reason was I had nothing to, rely on. Basically, what I'm saying is there is no other book that I could, that was my starting point. So everything I have written is basically, I created it. And for that, I had to go through the whole Greek literature and, Middle Eastern literature, European literature, then create a story that I have shared in this book. So it took a long time. But as a result of that, in the coming years, I think you will be seeing many more books, because I have so much of information that I have not been able to share. Because when I wrote this book, it was about 700 pages long. And the publishers told me that, no, they are not going to publish it. It should be about 125 to 150 pages. So I ended up writing this 220 pages, book. So I have lost a lot more information, which I'll be sharing in the coming years.
Right. That's very interesting. I would certainly look forward to that. So could you give an overview of what were the major mathematical achievements in ancient India? If you could give like the top 5 or so, what in your opinion?
Well, the number one is the, Hindu numerals. I mean, just think about it, how good Indians were. they came up with a number system with a where they used place value notations. Now, let me share this place, the beauty of this place value notation, where when we are writing 11, we are writing it as 1 and 1, not 10 and 1. The 1 on the left is equal to 10, means the location of the number dictates its magnitude. This innovation is so profound and so helpful. If you use the Greek number system or the Roman numerals, where you are writing 11 as 10 and 1, you cannot perform mathematical operations. In fact, when Copernicus wrote his book, tried to define this heliocentric solar system, he has written very clearly that I'm not going to use Roman numerals because they are slow in calculation, and therefore let me use Indian numerals or Hindu numerals. So, and those numerals are so easy and simple and so profound that we teach numbers 1, 2, 3 first before we teach alphabet to a child. So that's the profoundness of this number system. And so that's one decimal system that we use, binary number system, quadratic equations, Pythagorean theorem, the value of pi as an approximate value. In fact, Aryabhatta in his book Aryabhatta has mentioned that this is an approximate value because we cannot get an exact value. And to share the impact of India on or Hindus on other civilizations, for zero, which is among the top 100 inventions labeled by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS. It is called Shunya in India. When Arabs learned it, Shunya means nothing. When Arabs learned it, they chose a word that means Shunya, means nothing, and that word is Sifar. The Sifar became cipher in Latin. So, and that cipher, that we spell it with C, Italian decided that they are going to spell it with Z. And then French took it and it became zero. So that's the story of from Shunya to zero. It's a story. Just think about it. If we share it, to a elementary school kid around the world, they are going to say, oh, and if you tell them that this has come from India, they're going to say, what is India? Suddenly you have a reason to humanize that child, to globalize that child. We are missing that tremendous opportunity. Another example I can give, why do we call sine theta in trigonometry sine? Somebody must have chosen that word. The history of science is the history of human beings. So let me share. In India, this is the full code is called Jiva, and the half code which we use in trig is called Jaya. That's the word Aryabhatta used. When Arabs learned it, they thought, okay, let us choose a word that is similar to Jaya. And they ended up using a word Jib or Jabe. Jabe, lots of Indians will realize it, because it's commonly used in India. Jeb means pocket, which is an Arabic word. The literal translation of pocket in Latin is sinus. And then they decided that let us abbreviate it, and it became sin, but you don't call it sin. So we write it sin, but we pronounce it sign. And that's the history of sign. Now, most interesting thing is, again, that knowledge, you can find it in most dictionaries. You can find it in, in encyclopedias, but you are not going to find it commonly in a trigonometry book. Again, we are missing that opportunity to globalize our youth, which is a sad thing. And again, we are denying, the truth also in that process, which is a very sad thing. But I can assure you that within your lifetime, because I think you are a little bit younger than me, perhaps, you will see it is going to change. There is a massive movement that is going on around the world, and it is going to change. There is no question about it.
So, to the best of your knowledge, how old is the decimal system and the discovery of trigonometry, etc., in India? When did it happen?
Very interesting question. Aryabhatta wrote about it, in his book. And he said, by the way, Aryabhatta wrote that book when he was only 23 years old. And he wrote in that book that this is the ancient knowledge of India. Because that knowledge is dying, I am to revive that knowledge or to preserve that knowledge, I'm writing this book. So he did not claim that, he invented that knowledge. He called it an ancient knowledge. It is very, very difficult to pinpoint when it was invented. This is where I feel strongly that India must attract their best brains to work in this field. We do not know our own heritage, which is a sad, commentary. But the way things are evolving, my feeling is we will know a lot more about it. And part of the problem is a large number of Sanskrit manuscripts are not translated, as yet.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we find if we go back about 5,000 years before today, we have this so-called Harappan phase of our civilization, which was a highly industrialized, completely metropolitan phase of our civilization. All the towns, cities were very well planned. You had multi-storied buildings. You had standardization of weights and measures. So clearly, this was a scientifically and technologically advanced phase of our civilization. And it indicates that there was already a very advanced degree of knowledge at the time. So it's possible that the invention of the discovery or invention of the decimal system, zero, etc., may have happened at that time or even before that. Do you think it's likely?
By the way, if you measure the weights, standards that are base 10. I mean, so
base 10.
There is no doubt in my mind, in Vedas, which is definitely, we are talking of thousands of BCs, the word numerals that we are using that are base 10. So, there's a very little doubt about it that we have been using this system for a long time. The issue is, you know, to pinpoint a, you know, date, which is very, very difficult at this stage.
Indeed. So a lot of work needs to be done.
That's right.
That's right. So apart from mathematics, okay, let's continue the topic of mathematics. We also have the discovery of, we could call it calculus in ancient India. It's more recent, of course. It's a Kerala school of mathematics. But it clearly predates the so-called discovery of calculus by Newton and Leibniz, which coincidentally happened in the same year, which is rather strange. See, I think what's happening is that we had this Jesuit priests who were coming to India. The Jesuits are the scientific branch of the church. I mean, they are the ones who travel around the world and try and take out whatever science is there. So I think it is Jesuit priests who brought back knowledge of calculus, infinite series, etc. from India. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Newton and Leibniz, they both claimed to have discovered integral or differential calculus in the same year. So what are your views about this?
Oh, there is no question about it. In fact, I have just written an article which has accepted for publication about Newton. If you know the life of Newton, he was a historian. He was not performing experiment. He was trying to learn the hieroglyphics language of the Egypt, Arabic language of the Middle East, Mayan language of the Americas. Those were his efforts. So he was a historian, and he has written it very clearly by the, and that's a statement I have used in this article, which I have just published, that it's not the Greeks who who made major contributions in science. It is the Egyptians. And Greeks are learning it from the Egyptians. This is what Newton is saying it in his own book, Principia Mathematica. But that knowledge, that statement, you are not going to find, in any book. Although it's Newton who is saying it. And I said, well, if you respect really Newton, why are you ignoring that statement? I raised that issue, in this article. So many of these people, like the binary number system by Leibniz, it is fairly well accepted, it's not a popular knowledge, but it is reasonably well accepted that he learned it from China. So these people were historians. They were learning it, what is happening in other cultures, and then basically documenting it. Like, for example, when we talk about Newton, we say that, he made tremendous advances in optics. What we know is Ibn al-Haytham, that's the name of a Middle Eastern scientist who, around, to give an idea, we just celebrated in 2015 his 1,000 years. So the United Nations made 2015 as the year of Ibn al-Haytham, or the year of light. That's the, 2015 is called, known, by the UNESCO and United Nations. Now, why do we say, year of light? Because Ibn al-Haytham wrote a book, Kitab al-Manazir, a book on light. And Newton had access to that book. It can be documented today that Newton, had access to that book. It was a popular book in Europe. Newton had a copy of that, and many of his discoveries in optics are defined in that book by Ibn al-Haytham. But you pick up any physics book, you are not going to find about anything about Ibn al-Haytham. So the history of science that we are, teaching today, it is highly incomplete, and that caused, you know, that the famous Needham question. Needham said, why only Europe could do it and why not India and China? And then he answered it by, you know, compiling this giant work, you know, on the history of science in China. So there is no question about it that the history of science that we are teaching is Eurocentric and is highly incomplete. It got to revise, and within our lifetime, trust me, trust my word on that, it will be changed, because there are so many things happening around the world. The truth is coming out slowly, and I have very little doubt that it will change.
Right. So we spoke about the mathematical achievements, some of the highlights of ancient India. What about the scientific achievements? We have mathematics, we had all kinds of other sciences. So could you highlight some of the major scientific achievements of ancient of the ancient Hindus?
The main of achievement, I think, our document is the role of mind in the welfare of physical body. That's something, you know, Indians or Hindus knew it, and that's where yoga system and meditation and all these things, evolved. So mind plays a very important role in the welfare of body. So, for your viewers, happiness is a necessity if you want to live long and if you want to live healthily, you know. It's a necessity that has come from India. The system of medicine, we call it Ayurveda, that is also major contribution of India, where we are using, for example, we are using dietary restrictions to cure diseases. So, those kind of things are so commonly used in India, that in villages, people don't go to doctor. They first take care of this food as medicine. The way Ayurveda has evolved food as medicine, it is truly remarkable. Unfortunately, that knowledge is slowly disappearing in India. Another important innovation that I would like to share, that let's assume, we believe in geocentric solar system, that Earth is stationary and, Sun is moving around the Earth. If you believe in that, in that case, the inner planets, which is Mercury and Venus, will have the same period as the Sun, because Mercury and Venus are moving around the Sun. So it should be the period of Mercury, Venus, and Sun should be identical. If you read Aryabhatta's book, he has clearly mentioned three different periods for Mercury, Venus, and Sun, which is what we believe today. And clearly, that means his system was not geocentric, it was heliocentric. Yet, we have been teaching that Copernicus was the first person who came up with this idea. It's highly unlikely that you will find any mention of Aryabhatta in any book. So now, One more thing I would like to share. In year 2000, the AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, they documented, 100 inventions in our history. And out of those 100 inventions, one was Hindu astronomy. And I'm not saying by the Hindu, it is AAAS who is saying it, Hindu astronomy. That term, isn't, if you use it in India, you will be labeled as a, activist or radical, unfortunately. Now the issue is, if Hindus made that many excellent contributions that they have to be among the top 100, do we teach it? Do we share it? What have they done in astronomy books? No. That shows the incompleteness of our astronomy books. It is a very, very unfortunate, that the Hindu astronomy, as it is defined in Vedas and Upanishads and Puranas, unfortunately, we have not documented properly. And the migration of that knowledge from India to China or from India to Middle East, that has not been documented properly. But it is going to change also. I'm very, very hopeful. Then, to give you an idea how good, Hindus were, they even defined two virtual planets, Rahu and Ketu, which are basically the ascending and descending nodes. So that causes eclipse. These people were really serious observer of the sky, and unfortunately, their knowledge is not well documented, and that's the role our generation has to play to document it and pass it to the next generation. So I have documented medicine. I have documented astronomy. Let me talk about the concept of atom. Now, if you read Vaisheshika Sutra, it is so clearly defined there by Maharshi Karnad that there is something that is basic. We call it Parmanu, atom, That information, according to Karl Marx, that perhaps Democritus got it from India. But if you say that information today in India, there will be an uproar against it. So that's now yoga as the science of self-improvement. It is so remarkable. Just imagine that if we start practicing yoga on a regular basis, how our concentration will improve, how our body is going, physical body is going to improve, and we are missing all that opportunity. Now, talking about Hindu ecology, we worship mountains, we worship trees, we worship rivers. I mean, the Hindu lifestyle, which is largely, our eating habits are vegetarians, that inflicts minimal impact on planet Earth. It is a well-known, well-accepted fact. I wish, because 70% of the agriculture land, we are using it for rearing animals, basically, so that we can eat them. So the Hindu ecology, that's something, you know, we must follow, because in terms of diet, by the way, now the issue is, what is more beneficial? Milk-free diet means vegan diet or milk diet? And studies after studies, it comes out that milk diet is better than vegan diet. And it inflicts minimal impact on planet Earth. So all these contributions, you know, that they tell us, the work of, you know, J.C. Bose, that plants have life. These are all remarkable contributions. Bosons, you know, I'm talking about the recent period. Unfortunately, we have not documented them properly, and it's time to do that.
And I remember reading somewhere that even the speed of light was calculated to a reasonably good degree of accuracy in ancient India. Is there any truth to that?
Subhash Kak has done some work on that.
Okay.
And I know he comes to your program sometimes. Perhaps he can explain it. There are some people who indicate that in Hanuman Chalisa, that information is there, all those things. But I have not seen it, you know, in a scientific document, you know, where this can be defined clearly. By the way, I was very careful in writing my book. I documented only those things where there is some, you know, support, whether it's archaeological or literary support. So I intentionally ignored that question.
I see, right.
Yeah.
Why do you think India's contribution to science is not recognized? Was there a certain decision that was made in Europe about 500, 600 years ago that we're going to expunge all references to India in our history texts from our science?
There is not even a doubt about it. It is a fairly well accepted fact, you know, you know, that's the case. You know, because if you read the books written in Europe, just to give you an idea, you know, Fibonacci is very famous, you know, Leonardo Fibonacci, he's so famous, you know, in Italy. He has written in his book where he has defined Fibonacci number on the very first page in the beginning, that I am basically documented the knowledge of India in this book. And I'm going to different countries traveling to acquire that knowledge so that I could write this book. This was the situation when Leonardo Fibonacci, was living. And that Fibonacci number, Indians knew it long ago. So when Roger Bacon wrote it in 12th or 13th century, you know, India was a great civilization. When Said al-Andalusi, who was a Muslim living in Spain, when he wrote it, you know, he considered India to be the top nation in science and technology. And suddenly, when Max Müller and Monier Williams and William Jones came, suddenly India became a backward country, you know. That had to be Christianized, that had to be, you know, modernized, so history changed.
So would it be accurate to say that the entire foundation of modern science rests on ancient Hindu science?
Some statements we can easily make, like, for example, it is very well established that European Renaissance, that scientific revolution happened in Europe, happened because of the mathematical revolution in India. Because it was the mathematical knowledge of India that went to Europe via the Middle East, and that caused that revolution, scientific revolution. I can give you another example. How far advanced Indians were. The rust-free iron or the steel, that we produce. We are talking of the BC period in India, where we were producing steel. When Alexander captured Porus and then basically released him, Porus was very grateful to Alexander, and in return, Porus gave him lots of gifts, and one gift was 6,000 pounds of steel, something Alexander could not have and Indians could. Rust-free iron in India, like this iron pillar in New Delhi. By the way, that pillar is very popular, but actually there are lots of similar pillars in India, that are rust-free. It's just unfortunately they are not very popular. There is one in near Indore, and then near Bangalore and so on. There are many others, and in Odisha, So to give you an idea how far ahead Indians were, Michael Faraday, we are talking of now the modern period, he decided that he's going to produce steel. And he did try it, and he came up with a formula where it showed that steel is produced with iron, aluminum oxide, and silica. Obviously, that was not true. So Europeans could not reproduce that ancient Indian technology even just a few hundred years ago. We were far ahead. I can give you another example, of Indian technology, like this reverse distillation in the extraction of zinc. That is the production or smelting of zinc is a very complicated process. Only Indians could do it. That's the reason, zinc was not common in Europe till recently. Plastic surgery, I did not mention it. Now some people may wonder, why do we call it, plastic surgery? Because, plastic is so recent. How could Indians, could invent it in the BC period, Shushruta, because at that time there was no plastic. The truth is, this plastic surgery, the name has come from rhinoplasty, means the shaping of nose. And that's the, the origin of the word plastic surgery. That knowledge, we are talking of, thousands of years ago, and Europeans could not do it till recently. So Indians were far ahead, and I find it ironic, in India, because this plastic surgery became a, political issue, I think a year or so ago, where, in my view, academia totally failed its responsibility. When it became a major issue, whether Hindus knew plastic surgery or not, no academic person could come up and say that, okay, this is the proof. However, a large number of historians who were not even historian of science, they came and blasted the government for saying that plastic surgery, Indians knew plastic surgery. So my feeling is in India, and I'm sorry to say that, you know, academia is failing its responsibility to guide nation. They have to guide nation properly so that nation can become, you know, a superpower. Unfortunately, we are not taking risk. That's the environment in India, and it got to change. It has to change, you know, because it's not good for the country if academics, you know, they cannot lead the country.
Academics, it is their duty to guide the new generations, the future generations. Unfortunately, in India, what we find is that the entire system is rather mediocre. What the system does is that it identifies and destroys talent, and it promotes mediocrity. And the entire system is such that in order to get promotions, etc., as an academic, you need to be good at politics. You don't need to perform. And that's the kind of thing it is. So the entire system, the stakeholders are the academics themselves, not the students. That's how the system has been constructed since the colonial time, and nothing has changed. So I don't know when we're going to do it. But thankfully, this is the age of social media, so we can spread the right information via these various mediums. So I would like to ask you, what is it that set India's civilization apart in the old days? What enabled ancient Hindus to make so many scientific breakthroughs and discoveries? Why did so much ancient science, mathematics, all that emerge out of ancient India?
By the way, to me, perhaps that's the most important question. Because, you know, it happened because of this scientific temper in Hindu society. And let me explain what do I mean by the scientific temper in Hindu society. First, if you see how gurus are treated in Hindu society, they are so well respected that there is a festival, Guru Purnima, among the Hindus, that can only happen in a culture, in a society where knowledge is worshipped, where knowledge is, you know, appreciated. So that's number one. Now, second thing, how different Hindus are, you know, with respect to other cultures, you know. In India, you can, or in among the Hindus, you can achieve moksha, which is, you know, the ultimate goal for all Hindus. You can achieve moksha by excelling in physics, in astronomy, in music, in agriculture, in Ayurveda, and so on. So these these scientific disciplines were avenues for moksha. So to give an idea, when Aryabhatta wrote his Aryabhatiya, where he has defined astronomy and so on, he has clearly mentioned that if you can learn this knowledge, you will achieve moksha. Means astronomy was a tool for moksha, the ultimate goals for the Hindus. Vaisheshika Sutra, it is written clearly, if you can learn about the physical world, the concept of atom and the concept of gravity, by the gravity is very well defined, gravitational force in Vaisheshika Sutra. I have never seen that, you know, in any book, unfortunately, you know. It is clearly mentioned that if you can master that, you will achieve moksha. In Vishnu Purana, it says it very clearly that through knowledge, you can achieve moksha. So this is, you know, that's the mindset of the Hindus, that through fine arts, through sciences, they could achieve moksha. Now, another thing, which as a physicist, you know, you will appreciate it. In physics, if you want to evolve ideas, you always need somebody to give you some resistance to say, oh, it cannot be true. Then you have to evolve your ideas, you know. I mean, every time I come up with a new idea, I bounce it on my friends so that they give me resistance so that the idea can evolve. The power of questioning in that culture, Hindu culture, is so profound. Bhagavad Gita, Arjun could ask any question to Krishna, and Krishna did not say that, you stupid, follow me, otherwise you'll go to hell. He had to answer. And that's, we have Upanishads, we have Bhagavad Gita, we have, you know, no question is forbidden in that culture. So the power of questioning. In fact, it was common to resolve conflict through debate. You know, that was a Shastrarth, was a standard procedure to resolve differences. Nobody was killing each other. And as a result, no Galileo, no Bruno suffered ever in India. That did not happen. So the society was, had norms so that it was bound to, you know, prosper in science and technology. Another very beautiful thing that as a child, I feel bad that I did not know about it. Because today we have computer, so our documentation techniques are very good. But, you know, at that time, that was not the case. You write a book, even the book could not make, you know, 100 copies. So the knowledge was really fragile. And therefore, Indians came up with a unique, technique to document all their knowledge in the form of verses that they could memorize. So in India, books were burned, they were reproduced. While when, Alexandrian library was burned, Egyptians could not reproduce that knowledge, while Indians could. So the role of poetry in science, that is such a beautiful thing, among the Hindus. And I wish if, we can start using poetry in science teaching, because that's our main problem in science, you know, we cannot remember things, you know, we understand it, and then in a few days, we forget it. But with the Hindu technique, you know, that documentation technique was so good that they could preserve their knowledge. So all these things, were so effective in promoting science. And indeed, you know, Indians or Hindus did very, very well in the domain of science.
You spoke about the importance of the guru. We have a festival called Guru Purnima to honor our gurus. Do you think the institution of the guru has been, it's become obsolete? Gurus no longer exist? Because Indians today, they are taught that, they're told that their teachers and professors are their gurus. But that's not quite what a guru is, right? Guru is a very, very highly advanced and intellectually and scholarly person. Today's teachers, today's PhDs, I don't think they quite can reach the status of a real guru. What do you think about that?
See, what you are talking about in the absolute sense, perhaps you are right, because the gurus that, in the ancient period in among the Hindus, You know, those people were sort of realized people, you know. They experienced life in a way that not only the abstract knowledge that they were imparting, but even the way of living and so on, they were teaching it in the old Gurukula system. So the modern gurus may not be as good at them, but they are playing the same role. And as a result of them, they should be, respected. Unfortunately, when I left India, I know only that period, which is more than four decades ago. The salaries were so bad in for professors in India, that they could not even support a simple lifestyle. That was the situation, you know. But as I hear that today, I think it's a lot better. My feeling is the story of success that we have in India, it is so remarkable. Unfortunately, it has never been shared with the Indians. What we have achieved, in the last 75 years, we are celebrating, have we grown or have we gone back or what, you know, that conversation is not there, you know. And I think that's where, again, I fault the media and the academia that they are not doing their role. They are not doing their job, you know. And I think it should change. But I do not know if that will happen right now or not.
So, in your opinion, what should India do? I mean, how can India rediscover her latent greatness in the sciences and as a civilization? Because we have always been a scientifically advanced civilization. It's only in the past few centuries that we have lost that because of various external factors. What do we need to do to regain that greatness?
I think if the country can remain stable, that's all. Because Hindus and Indians, we are so innovative. That's who we are, that things will evolve if the society is stable. Unfortunately, in India, if you see our history of the last, more than 1,000 years, we have never been stable. We had to face invading forces continually. And I can give you one, statement, which Al-Biruni, the Islamic philosopher who came with Mahmud Ghazni, he was sponsored by Mahmud Ghazni. He has written is it okay if I read it? I have somewhere in front of me. This is a quotation. Mahmud utterly ruined the prosperity of the country and performed their wonderful exploits, by which the Hindus became like atoms of dust scattered in all directions, and like a tale of old in the mouth of the people. Their scattered remains cherish, of course, the most inveterate aversion toward all Muslims. This is the reason too why Hindu science have retired far away from those parts of the country conquered by us and have fled to places which our hands cannot yet reach to Kashmir, Benares, and other places. So here is a person who is a Muslim, and he's admitting that we are destroying science. That is not a one time or one incident. It happened for hundreds and hundreds of years, even from their own document. And if you don't believe that document, let's trash it or accept it. What we are doing is we are selectively choosing certain things, you know. And that's a sad commentary, you know. So if we can provide some stability in the country, I think we can easily take care of it. And let me share with you how good the Indian scientists are today. Give you some idea about that, because, you know, lots of people don't understand it. When India gained independence, the population of India was 340 million people. Only 340 million people, and we were starving. Today, population is 1.2 billion people, and we are exporting grains to Afghanistan and elsewhere. That's a story of success, the Green Revolution, that happened because of the scientific innovations. It's a story only very few countries in the world can share. Now, even a simple small pistol or bullets, we were importing it from other countries at the time of independence. Today, we are selling fighter planes to other countries, including countries like Australia and America, highly advanced country. Space technology. We could not even fly a small plane, as you know. Today we are landing going to the moon and Mars. So Indians have done extremely well, but for some reason we have a habit of constantly complaining about ourselves, how miserable we are, particularly in the media. Now, just think about it, how bad it is, you know, and I get very angry when I think about it. How can you unite a country if you are constantly complaining and talking about what it is not? The reason history of science is so distorted, if you go in Russia, they teach a different history of science than Germany or than in England, because, or China. Each country is designing their own history of science because they are highlighting their own contributions, because they can unite the country. In India, we are missing that opportunity. I think it got to change. And again, social media, which I do not know much about, unfortunately, because I'm from a generation where we were taking notes on a piece of paper rather than using Zoom or all these new programs. Academia and social media, they have to change. You cannot build a society by constantly complaining. You have to celebrate your own strengths rather than feel miserable about your own miseries, you know. And that got to change. Health industry. Just think about it, how much India has done, how well India has done during COVID. I mean, today, India is gaining respect of so many countries because they are supplying COVID vaccine. So India has a lot to talk about. Unfortunately, we have not focused on those issues, and it should change.
It certainly needs to change. I think the problem is the mainstream media, which keeps on focusing on negativity and tries to create divisions in the society, and that it's all agenda driven, but social media hopefully brings out the truth. So I agree, we cannot keep on complaining. We need to unite instead of trying to divide ourselves. Absolutely, I agree.
That's right.
So what are your future plans? You said you had created a 700 plus page manuscript and you were able to only publish 220 pages or so. So all of the remaining material, are you going to bring it out in the form of a book, two books, three books?
Definitely. The first thing is, I have, if you read my book, I have focused only till 5th century. So mm-hmm. I talked about Aryabhatta, but I did not talk about Brahmagupta and, you know, this calculus in Kerala and so on. So I plan to do that. And my problem was I had to, cut this artificial deadline of 5th century because that's the only way I could keep that book short. So I will be writing. But the most important, project that I have right now, and I'm almost done with that project, is how knowledge migrated from India to the Middle East. If you read, like, for example, we talk about Harun al-Rashid, the great, emperor in Iraq or in South, in Baghdad, and his contribution to science and technology. What we never talk about is who was his advisor. His advisor was a Buddhist from Kashmir who taught him the knowledge, who shared with him knowledge of India, and that's, it can be very well documented now today. Let me share another thing, very important thing. We went to China, captured the whole country, because China became a Buddhist country, captured not in the political sense, but in the cultural sense. They became Buddhist without killing a single human being. There was no atrocities inflicted on China. It was Chinese who, decided to change their religion. Now, why did it happen? If you read that, it's a beautiful story, which is not shared with the Indians as yet. If you go study the role or the history of Tang Dynasty, which is a very powerful dynasty, they had a Bureau of Astronomy, basically astrologer, whose role was to tell the emperor what he should do and what he should not do. If you know the history of the Tang Dynasty, majority of astrologers they had were Indians. So Indians were going and guiding Tang Dynasty. That was the power of knowledge. And that's how, if you, there is a Indian philosopher, Sang Mitra, that there were war in China, that who is going to be host for Sangmitra. I mean, this was the reputation of the Indians. And all these travelers who came from China to India lived in Nalanda and elsewhere, went back to China and became famous in China. That was the power of India. That story has never been shared. So I want to share those stories, that the migration of knowledge did not happen only from Greece to the Greece to other cultures. There were some other centers also that where the knowledge migrated from those places to elsewhere. So from India to Middle East and from India to China. I am going to write something on those two issues.
Fantastic. I look forward to those books.
Yeah, I would love to come. I mean, I'm almost done. The only reason I have not published is I have so many other projects that, you know, because my bread and butter is teaching physics. So I have to work there also. So I'm not finding enough time, but soon I think I have reached an age. I've been teaching for 42 years. So I think it's about time to, you know, retire perhaps, and then I will come up with these books.
Right, fantastic. So I really look forward to that. In the meanwhile, I would like to encourage all the viewers to acquire this book. This is a fantastic book. This is the best book I have found ever about ancient Hindu science. So congratulations on publishing this book, and I look forward in the future to seeing more works from you, because the work you're doing is fantastic.
Thank you so much again. I'm truly honored, you know, I'm so thankful to you that you gave me this opportunity to share my knowledge with your viewers, which I feel, you know, like I was saying it before, that it is my responsibility that I must share that knowledge so that knowledge can be, you know, preserved. And I strongly believe that knowledge is divine. So I'm so lucky to have this opportunity. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're most welcome, sir. It's a great pleasure.